Howdy, y'all. Hello, friends, neighbors, and comrades. How the hell are ya? If you're new here, this is Rednecks Rising Podcast. I sure hope you're in the right place. We are an anti-fascist, anti-capitalist, anti-racist, and we're going to talk about this a little bit more today, anti-Zionist Appalachian podcast. My name is Chelsea. I'm your host, along with my friends Tiara and Sierra. Altogether, we're three loudmouth Appalachian women who are speaking truth to power, taking our turns, going down rabbit holes, and doing our best to plant some seeds of radical healing and direct action along the way. As for me, I'm tuning in from the ancestral lands of the Salagi people, also the modern home of their descendants, the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians, which you may know as the Appalachian Mountains of Western North Carolina. And as for you, I sure hope that you're doing okay today, wherever you're tuning in from, because there is a whole lot of grief and pain and heaviness and horror all across the world. And speaking of which, today I am recording this introduction on Monday, April 8th, which is when this episode will be published, although the conversation was had earlier last week. So before we jump into this episode, given the timing, I want to take a moment to recognize and to pay tribute to the life of Cole Brings Plenty. Cole was a 27-year-old actor and a citizen of the Cheyenne River Sioux tribe, who a lot of folks were familiar with for his role in the TV series 1923. His body was found deceased in a wooded area in Kansas after he was assaulted at a concert. And as far as I know, the situation is under investigation. There's not a whole lot of details, but most importantly, we just want to send so much light and love and solidarity to him and his family and his loved ones. And we hope that everyone can find peace and justice in this situation. In today's episode, I am so excited that we get to take some time to get to know one of our new co-hosts, Tiara. She's an all-around badass activist doing a lot of great work in solidarity with the movement for Palestinian liberation. She's a mom. She's an incredible friend. And this conversation went on for, we actually had to come back to it a second day when we were recording, so 6 hours, which means that this episode is actually the first of many episodes. And in this first part, Tiara and I start off by talking about healing from the way that the culture, TM, of white supremacist, capitalist, patriarchal, imperialist, ableist, etc., culture forces us to dissociate from our bodily experiences and instead constantly to be on red alert, thinking about if we're doing enough to be worthy of love and how traumatizing that is. Then Tiara dives into the importance of speaking truth to power, of showing solidarity across race and culture, of showing up as white people in white bodies while centering the voices of others when we do so. We touch on the importance of independent media and utilizing our platforms to help deepen that solidarity and amplify the voices that need to be heard. And Tiara shares her experience in the realm of movement organizing for a free Palestine, from showing up to participate in direct action to raising funds for families on the ground in Gaza. We bring everything together. We tie it up real nice with a bow by connecting the dots between Palestine and Appalachia, because ultimately, when we talk about Palestine, we are talking about Appalachia. And if you enjoy what you hear in today's episode, you can contribute to keeping this show on the air, because it's not free to make this or publish it. And you can do that by going over to our Ko-fi page, Ko-fi page, however you want to say it, Ko-fi. You can also share the show with your friends, leave us a rating and review, all of the things. You know what to do. I'm going to shut up now and let us dig into the show. Just kidding. Not going to shut up quite yet, because one last thing I do want to offer is a trigger warning. This episode does start to touch on the violence of what is being experienced in Gaza at the hands of the Israeli government. And it also touches on childhood trauma, abuse, death. So if that's not something that you feel you have the capacity for, I encourage you to come back to this episode, at a different time. Okay, let's jump in.
I didn't do anything because, again, I keep thinking this is just a podcast for, like, sound, not face.
It is. The face is just the cherry on top. Like, this is just people get to see us as a treat. The podcast is the real, the entree here.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
Look at those. Speaking of looking good, look at the girlies.
Thank you. Thank you. This is their first
time.
How
are you healing up?
I'm okay. I'm still not supposed to be putting my hands above my head.
So stop.
I made Easter dinner. And I'm still not supposed to be lifting anything heavier than a paper bag. And all of that sounds insane. So, I do slightly more than that, but I'm fine.
When your boobies prolapse, you're gonna not be saying that.
Listen, he has me in a fortress.
Good.
And I think that he was very aware, because I was very, I'm an asshole, but I'm a very self-aware asshole. So right out of the gate, my first appointment with him, I was like, when can I go back to the gym? And he's like giving me like the normal, like, and then if you do this or you go on the elliptical, and I was like, I'm doing none of that. This is what I do there now. This is what I'm physically capable of. And my mental issue with this is going to be that I'm going to hurt myself, realistically, if you let me guide myself into this. So give me your harshest guidelines whenever I ask you these questions. It was like the first meeting we had, and he was like, got it. So when we were talking, I was like, when can I go back to the gym? He said, week 6. That's it. Like, otherwise it started at week 2 and worked its way in.
Mm-hmm.
And like the last possible phase was week 6. So I follow his strictest guidelines.
Good.
So I was like, I've been putting my hands up. And he was like, does it hurt? I was like, no. He's like, okay, fine. So yeah, because they were an investment. Okay. They were an investment.
Heck
that
yeah,
I
they were.
Waited years and years. I waited a decade for these things. Talk
so
about
it
patience.
Wasn't, I was, that was going to be one of my questions is like, so was it the revolution that you decided you needed? You needed to spruce up, you know, to be able to pull in some money for, or was it other things?
No, actually, it was a thing from before I even knew Cody. And so I got pregnant really young with Aubrey and felt like, due to childhood trauma and all that stuff, teenage trauma, that I didn't really ever have control of my own body, if you know what I mean, like in a very deeper, like kind of way. And then when I got pregnant with her, after I like became a woman, everything changed about the way I looked physically. And I remember it's the saddest boob job story you're ever going to hear. So get ready for the emotions.
I did warn the people that. So, there are going to be emotions tonight.
Yeah, no, see, because here on the outside, I can seem real shallow and flighty and angry and impulsive, but I swear to God, there's so much brewing under the surface that gets me there. So my body changed drastically because I got like preeclampsia.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the end, it was really bad. I was induced with her and had a horrible delivery. And afterwards, everything about me looked completely different. And I was 20. And I had flashbacks to being younger and watching my mom stand in the mirror and cry and point out all the things that were wrong with herself, which is why it's so important as mothers that we never do that in front of our mm-hmm. children. And I looked just like her. And her and I did not have a great relationship. And, you know, we don't talk now even. And so it hurt in a different kind of way to look at myself because I didn't see myself. I saw her because she had me really young and she was trapped. I fell into the same cycle that I had tried so desperately to avoid. That was a family cycle. And so every time I looked at myself, I saw a lack of control of my own body. Her conception wasn't exactly consensual either. So like I really saw a complete utter loss of control of my body. And so it was around that time that like I really started thinking about, you know, moving forward with my life alone and what I wanted that to look like and what I wanted to have it feel like to take myself back. So that's when I started going to the gym. Right around the time, like right before I split from her father, because she has a different dad. My oldest has a different dad too. I decided that that was something I wanted to do. And that to me, body positivity is, I think anybody looks amazing. Someone could look just like how I did, and that's wonderful for them. And I think that they're beautiful and perfect in every freaking way. But I didn't feel like myself in there. And when I looked at myself, I saw the things that took me from myself. Because then I was in an abusive relationship and I did have an abusive mother. So like again, everything I saw was just everything I didn't want to see. Not necessarily me. And so for me it was, okay, in this one situation though, if I can change it and feel at home again, then I'm being positive about my body because this is trauma. And I could sit and I could put the time into getting over it. I'm sure of it. But look at all the other things on my plate I'd have to put down to do that. And at what point in time is it a mental health investment? And the statistics on that are insane. It helps with postpartum depression. It helps with manic depression. Like it treats so many depression symptoms for women
Well,
because you don't feel at home.
it's affirming, and it's really parallel and like serendipitous that you're naming this, because it was actually just a couple of days ago that I saw a meme that said like gender affirming care needs to exist for cis people too. Like when women get boob jobs, that is gender affirming care. When men get hair replacement or even Viagra, like that is gender affirming care. Like,
If you can change it and it makes you happy, babe, do it. As long as you're doing it in a way that's harmful to yourself. Like, go for it if we can. Like, it's. And if you're blessed to be able to, and again, this was a long time coming. And I swear my money drawer was working extra hard in that point in time. And I, honest to God, Chelsea, I was like, I swear if this exact dollar amount comes in next time, by this date, like this much, then I'm taking it as a go. And it came in and went right back out. Cause I was like, no, that's it. That's what it means. And it was a mental health investment. I think, you know, you all, Sierra sends me regular messages. Like just saying like I'm so happy to like see you being like this like in yourself. And I was like, yeah, I forgot. I really forgot because even like just over the years too, it you just start to lose who you are more and more. Because if you look at yourself and you don't see yourself, then like when do you stop being yourself? So yeah, it was not a normal, not a normal. And then the other step is actually just good marketing.
Yeah,
Good
just
marketing, I guess. Like I'm like,
convenient
well, they're
that
here.
it happens to be something that patriarchy wants to commodify, and we can use that to your advantage.
No, then that was the thought process too when it had been discussed, the purchase and whatnot, back and forth, was we decided that it made it like it was a sensible investment because I could make the money back on them.
Yeah.
So even though I'm putting it in, and again, it took time. The appointment, you book them way out, you pay them way in advance, and then it builds all the way up through. And then you wait very impatiently for a very long time. But yeah, and now it's Sierra and I have talked about this, and she so gets it, and I love her this about her so much because she has been so affirming to me in every decision like this that I've ever made. Whether I choose to keep it or change it, she's 110% about it. And it's ridiculous when you have things, especially like body dysmorphia, where it's the ridiculous the kind of situations you can be in, how intense they can be, how important they can be, and your mind still obsessive compulsively goes to, what do I look like right now? Oh God, stand like this. Should I move like this? What do I look like in this shirt? And that takes up too much brain space. We
And
can't be
it's
doing that.
also so it removes us from our feelings, like what is actually happening inside of our body, as opposed to like what is our body being perceived as to people outside of this body, which is, I think, as we get into the meat of tonight's conversation, we're going to talk about things that are really heavy and how we make space for those heavy things by not turning away from them, not taking up all of that brain space and like trying to cognitively and intellectually rationalize what we're perceiving, what we're experiencing, but instead like actually noticing what's happening in our body so that we can then move from that space of either alignment with our body or misalignment with our body. And yeah, so I think that like it's not just I, so one of the papers I wrote in college that was like one of the first radicalizing works that I like actually like put my own words onto paper about was about this book called The Beauty Myth. And a lot of it was about how like patriarchy not just like teaches us to hyper criticize ourselves as w women, but really all humans, and how we appear, but it also commodifies that like insecurity and that self-consciousness. What it didn't name in that book that I think now 10 plus years later I've come to realize is that it also plays that emotional intelligence role as well, where it distances us from what we're actually feeling on top of putting those expectations and that profit scheme on us. And so there's even that like deeper, that's the piece that's really traumatizing, is the like dissociating us from the what are we experiencing in order to like take our mind to how do I look right now? What is, how does this person perceive me? Am I pretty enough? Am I sexy enough? Am I looking, am I making the right face right now? But whatever.
Yeah, no, and it, you're 1,000% right, and I feel that on such a deep level too, because again, it's my trauma that would make me so easily triggerable then, right? So now it has reminded me that I am not who I was told that I was, you know? And you really like it keeps you focused in important situations when you're not worried about those kinds of things, even when things go off the rails, because the confidence carries over into other aspects. You know what I mean? Like when you're not insecure about that, then I remember who the fuck I am, and I'm like, no, I wouldn't be saying this unless I fucking knew it was true, and I'm absolutely right about this. And like, don't you fucking tell me I'm wrong. You're gaslighting me right now. Because when you're out of that whole like, oh my God space, then you can step up so much more for yourself.
And you're not
And
trying to like get out of your body. So you can actually be attuned to like, my body is telling me that this is wrong. Like, my body is reacting to what you are saying from a place of your principles are not aligned with my
I hear my
principles.
situation better.
Exactly.
And that
Yes, that's it.
there's other stuff going on in my head.
Yes. Well, I mentioned how EMDR saved my life in the group chat the other day. And I had this, it was like multiple sessions of EMDR that I eventually had this one session last year after the grippy sock vacation when I got back into real life and was trying to recover. And I had this really powerful session where I ended up like EMDR, basically you have to unfortunately like recall traumatic memories and the messages that those memories like ingrained in your brain. So the message for me was a message of I have to prove my worth. So fun fact about me, I was in beauty pageant. I was a literal toddler beauty pageant participant. Toddlers and
Was
Tiaras,
it
not the TV show, but I was Little Miss Asheville in 1997. And so from a very young age, I was always like the message of like I have to perform at like as worthy, right? Like that's how I like get the adults, the people to keep me alive, nurture me, love me, whatever. We were really poor, and like that was one of the things that like my mom poured a lot of her time and energy into, instead of love, unfortunately. And so I laugh awkwardly about it. It's not funny, but it is now that I've done the work. Anyways, so I was doing this EMDR session and like had this just memory that came out of the black hole. You know how it is when you like don't remember most of your childhood. And it wasn't this like extremely like traumatic, violent memory, but it was like a memory of the person I was that had been left behind so that I could perform more worthy, right? And like this per like I had totally lost even the memory of that person. Like that was where the black hole was. And I just cried and cried and cried and literally felt like this sense of like gravity. Like I could feel the way I described it to my therapist was I feel the weight of my legs again. Like it had been so long since I had actually felt my body and not like I was performing. Am I performing right? Am I like doing all of the right things? Will they love me? Am I worthy of love? Am I going to be disposed of? And like for the first time, I was like in my body. And she said to me, she's not religious. And she, you know, she's like, I don't want to like put any sort of like faith that you don't believe in on you. And she's like, but maybe your spirit finally felt safe enough to come back into your body.
Maybe your spirit.
And
That's
if
such
it takes a boot job for your
a
spirit to feel safe enough to come back into your body, what under white supremacist capitalism, whatever the fuck it takes for your spirit to be able to be the one that is steering the fucking ship.
Here's an Appalachian Palestine story.
Oh my
My mama.
gosh, I'm so ready.
And you'll get a little bit of history too. So the reason I protest, the whole reason I ever started protesting is because I know that the image of me protesting is impactful. Especially when I'm out there with my gaggle of little white boys and my angry little white girl, and we're all clearly a bunch of goddamn rednecks. Our backpack has like Rednecks Against Racism and stuff like that all over it that we carry with us. We have a little Carhartt backpack. My one boy will wear his red bandana a lot. So we'll have red bandanas and keffiyehs. Last time we went down, we actually had them carry an Appalachians for a Free Palestine sign. And there were several people who stopped us to say we've never seen one like that before. And then, like, a lot of the times we'll just say, why? And I'm like, why not? Because it's the bare minimum. My response in those scenarios when they're like, thank you for being here, nice to meet you, I'm always like, I'm so sorry I have to be here and I wish I met you under better circumstances. Like, because it's bullshit that you even feel inclined to say thank you to me because we should all be there because it relates to us. Because my mother and my mother had a really rough life too. So I'll gloss over why it is her and I don't really like each other with just the, well, we didn't like each other or whatever, with just we didn't, it was valid on my end and then some. And no, went to a lot of therapy over it. But she's a broken woman, and I think she's, I think this might be one of the biggest moments in her life where she is really truly trying to change who she is as a person too. And she has sh given, she personally has given me hope, even though I still don't really talk to her, that the change can and will start at home. So a lot of why we don't talk has to do with our background and our ideals. My parents were not happy with me in 2020 because I raised a stink on a big scale. Doxxed by the Pennsylvania State Militia, big scale. My mom having people from high school remove her off Facebook and send her a bunch of real bitchy messages, big scale. We didn't even talk. And it was a lot of personal things, but it was also a lot of beliefs. Apple falls real far from the tree with me. I think, honestly, the autism every single day that I don't remember a day in my life agreeing with any of those ideals, even though they were shoved down my throat. But like that's how like I was like in 2020, I know it's not about supporting the police. I know it's about being racist because y'all raised me. Don't tell me I don't know why you're out here. You said it in front of us as kids. Because we didn't have good solid internet access, honest to God, until I was like dang near in high school. I didn't really realize, I never like, I didn't run around using it because it felt gross and I knew it was like taboo and I knew it was said in a derogatory way, but I didn't know how derogatory some of like the slurs were because I heard them so casually, constantly, that like it went from me being like, oh, they like, they're awful, to being like, oh my God, they're hateful. It was one of those where it became almost like watered, not watered down to the point where it was tolerable, but still like, it didn't make me flinch as much anymore because you just hear it constantly. So it's again, it's like, don't tell me that y'all aren't out here because you're not just a bunch of racists. Because I Googled some of the stuff you told me when I was a kid and it is not okay. And that's another reason why I hate TikTok. But I digress. Because otherwise, I truly grew up in such a remote area and did not leave because I was so poor that our family vacation was camping at my aunt and uncle's like 10 minutes out the road. I was just who I was around. Again, I didn't even have access to the internet until I was like a June at the end of my junior year in high school, like at home. I just knew what felt right and what felt fucking wrong. And again, I just thanked the autism that I was never a horrible dick. And I was just like, that doesn't make any sense because that person's just like me, only this. And I know in the past that there are definitely instances where I fucked up and dropped the ball. And I have spent also a lot of time in therapy going back over those. Not to like, white guilt myself, but to really address like how to properly own it and make sure that everything about it has changed. Because again, you're fucking indoctrinated into that shit. That's how we
Well,
get these people.
yeah, and I think like we touched on this a little bit in the last episode together. Like, I think part of it, there are those who either don't have principles or have the deeply misguided principles. The folks who are just like outwardly racist, say the things and know what they're saying, and then try to put on the aesthetic of like, no, that's not me, whenever it's like called attention to. But then there are, and this is the part that we brought up on the last episode, there are those who it is coming from a place of that indoctrination, or the flip side of that is like trauma, where it's like it's coming from a place of needing to feeling like they're saving themselves by stepping on another group, like proving like it almost the message that I got as a kid, right? Like proving like, don't dispose of me. Like I'm at least more worthy than this other group, right?
I go on tangents about that. That is, did I tell you about the stare-off I got into with a cop in DC the other week? Oh, it was ridiculous. It was awkward. It was prolonged, and it only ended because Cody's sign happened to come down between the two of us. And by the time it went back up, I was turned around because otherwise we would have been there all day. Like God parted the seas, like sent Moses down. I don't know. Just and it was just me and the student because it pisses me off so much how they create classism within groups just so that some person within that marginalized group can feel like they're better than fucking someone else. And that's why they
Well,
have the
that's they.
over-policing of Black people by Black cops in Washington, D.C., because
Yeah.
they pay them a six-figure salary so they can say at least they're a higher class and at least they didn't turn out like those guys. But those guys are just fucking like them. They were just pulled out and weaponized, and now they're literally policing their brothers and sisters to say that they're fucking better than somebody because capitalism says just don't be at the bare fucking bottom, which is, of course, then why we see Indigenous and Black women being treated like shit all the time because people have to keep them at the fucking bottom so that someone's at the fucking bottom because
Yep.
everyone has to, for some reason, listen to the white colonial, like settler mindset here, where we're just, there has to be a hierarchy, which is why I'm an anarchist, because everybody is equal across the board. Everyone's life holds equal value. Until you start acting like a dick, and we get to push you into the woods.
Yep, exactly. Nope, Yes, I talked to there's a leader in the anti-racist decolonization movement, Desiree Stevens. I have an episode with her where we literally talk about white supremacist. I call it, so you, if someone's listening to this for the first time, or maybe you haven't heard this before, but I refer to it as just the culture trademark, but I'm referring to white supremacist capitalism ultimately, which is the hierarchy, but within that hierarchy, there are other hierarchies that are all like it's a fucking bridge that's holding itself up. And that's what Desiree does such a good job at articulating. And she challenges us to center the most marginalized voice in the room. And in theory, that would be like the disabled, either really old or really young, trans, black, human being, like, you know, and like whoever is the most marginalized, like that is the voice that should be uplifted as the person with the clearest view from inside of that, like,
That is
bullshit.
what I think biblically to me. I will pull in a bunch of biblical stuff, whether or not I believe in it necessarily as it is
I
or
love
not. I'll
that.
randomly. But to me, that is standing with the least of us, as we're called to do. And it's
Yes.
shown me truly, and I think that like this statement might have been something that kind of like hit my mom and it's been hitting people and I pointed out. I'm realizing now that that's Palestinian children. Because we watched each year a new movement come into light and people drop off more and more and more and more and more. I remember being out there for Roe v. Wade, pregnant, waddling around, going, where the fuck are all the people I was out here for last year? And then the next year, same thing. And the next year, the same thing. And then I got to this, this last fall, and tell me why my family plus one white dude were the only white people there out of like 200 people the first time I went. And then like I was the day that I was asked to speak and I did and somehow ended up on Al Jazeera. And I remember Cody being like, kind of like it upsets me that they picked you to run on there. And I said it did at first too. And then I realized in that scenario we're the minority. And they were just trying to get a minority's opinion on the matter in the West, like, because not a lot of white people were coming out to speak on it. And I was there screaming at Joe Biden about being a war criminal while he touched down in Europe. But that was a gift from the universe, and that's a story for another time, because that was the most magical moment of my entire life, and that is why I believe in karma and the power of the universe and the ability to go into some place inside yourself where you can go and you can meet other people, and that's a whole spiritual thing we can talk about. But I did it that day, and it freaking worked because I asked the universe for me, the ability for me to let them know that I cared about them and that I was hurting and that I couldn't get up and I was sick. And this was not long after October 7th, and I was like, and I know I've been trying this form of meditation I was reading about in this book, and it was actually a book like based upon the teachings of Mary Magdalene, which were based upon the teachings of Jesus when they found Mary's books like 100 years ago. So I was practicing that and I was like, I can't do this yet. Can we figure out how to make a miracle happen? Like, please. And then the next that night, my friend Nyla got a hold of me and said, like, which we didn't even know each other really yet. And she's like, I feel compelled to ask you to speak tomorrow. Can you do that? And I was like, if you ask me, I'm going to do it. This is the most nerve-wracking thing of my life. I stayed up all night long and I wrote something and I ended up going on and on for like 20 minutes, cutting myself short. We were all crying. And then I found out later that the camera there was literally Al Jazeera live. And it was the 10 o'clock news in the Middle East. And they ran at me to like 10:01. And I was just listing off horrible things I'd seen and I was crying. And I was promising them that I was never going to stop watching because I've been watching for much longer. Then since October 7th, it's been over a decade. We have books in our house for adults and for children about the real conflict of the Middle East and things like that. And our children have grown up learning these things, which is why we cyber charter school. I was just crying with them and telling them that I loved them. But I had no idea who the heck the camera was. Like, what? It was Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Like, and it ran during the part that I was telling them that I loved them and I was so sorry and I was mourning and all of the things that I had wanted to say. And I felt like the universe was like, here, Kira, like, here's your miracle. Like, just go tell them yourself. And one of the girls that was with me, she was saying how her father, right before I spoke, her father had been losing hope that people were going to look away again, like they always did. And she was saying how, no, it's different this time. It's different this time. He was, no, like, it's really only, the Muslims over there that ever really care too, and then nothing gets done. And she was like, no, it's different. It's different. And this was the last day, I believe, that they ran, that they were able to easily access Al Jazeera there in their homes. And when it ran, she was standing beside me. And I was like, I really hope her dad saw that. It's different this time. It really is. And I noticed that people got as mad as I am faster. And that's how I can tell if a movement's actually picking up speed. People go to as mad as I get, as like a lot faster. But yeah, that's why I believe in the power of the universe, because what the hell are the odds? But oh, my mother. So we can actually get something of this, and then maybe I'll
Before
give you
you get to
something.
your mom, I just want to like hold space for that story. And like, I'm literally my, I just have chills all over, and it feels so important to name that. Like, I think that faith and that belief in the universe is actually an imperative ingredient to the movement and to, I'm like, I'm gonna start crying now. The to creating the world that we want to see. Howdy, y'all. Want to just take a quick break. Sorry to interrupt, but let's stretch, shake out any tension we are holding. And while we are at it, I want to point out that if you are not new around here, then you may have noticed there haven't been any external advertisements on the most recent episodes. That was a very intentional, conscious decision to move away from external advertisements and ads that don't align with the values of our show. Instead, this week's episode is made possible through the power of homemade bread, staying hydrated, that's your reminder, the beginning signs of spring, and of course, listeners like you. We use Ko-fi or coffee as our sustaining platform, which is an alternative to Patreon that allows folks to contribute by becoming a monthly sustainer or just throwing a few bucks our way as a special occasion. Tierra and Sierra are working with some of their amazing friends to put together new merchandise and other perks for folks who become sustainers over on Ko-fi, so it doesn't have to be a one-woman show anymore. And we're going to be rolling out some exciting stuff in the coming weeks, so you won't want to miss out. We know money's tight right now for all of us, though. Literally, like, we're all struggling. So if you can't financially support the show, absolutely no hard feelings. It's equally as awesome of you to share us with all of your friends on social media, by word of mouth, via carrier pigeon, whatever floats your boat. Also, leave us a rating and review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your content. And don't forget to hit the subscribe button so that you never miss an episode. Because I think if we are like, yes, the anger is righteous, and yes, the rage and the even the want for revenge, all of those things are totally valid and totally righteous. And if they consume all of us and don't leave room for that grief and that love and that faith that the universe does want to use us as the vehicles to create the change that we feel called to create. Like, I think it would be so easy for us to turn into the same kind of black hole that the powers that be are have turned into, like just being consumed and imploding, but with that.
I think is that faith that makes me, at least I know for sure, feel connected to other people then. And it's what keeps me here. And it makes me remember to do these things not out of hate, but honestly, the anger that I feel is out of love. And I had kind of mentioned, like, touched on it in the group chat with you, but like the first time I went to a protest, one of the for this event, this step of this genocide, someone had asked me why I came there, like why I just clearly just grabbed my stuff and came. And I said I needed to be in a space where I knew everyone was mourning the way that I was mourning. Because when I look at them, I just see innocent, good people in a cage being terrorized. And I need other people who I needed to be around other people who understood that. And unfortunately, there wasn't at the time a lot of diversity in the group of people there then that showed up. And so it looked like me mourning with a large group of Arabic people because they were the only people who were as sad as I was. And that. I just sat, I truly just, I will not speak unless asked or spoken to. I am there to hold space in a way in which represents a different group of people visually, and to share that information then with people like me. I'm there because it makes a visual impact. I'm there because it's the right thing to do, but I'm never there like for any reason other than that, because for the most part, truly nothing horrible is happening to me in the grand scheme of things. I don't go to events specifically for me. I do it because like my brothers and sisters in this world are being harmed and it's the thing to do. And that is, I think, something that built a very deep sense of trust between all of us very immediately. My Muslim friends gave my kids Christmas gifts and they found out we were having a hard time on Christmas, like unprompted. Like Cody needed work and he had work like within an hour whenever my friend found out and her husband had work for him. Like they be just because they sense my genuine solidarity. And I think it's important like that your solidarity be genuine. And I think this is a really good test of people right now to figure out if they're in things for the right reason or not. And to speak on the tolerance of Islam, truly, I describe my faith when prompted by anyone Muslim who asks me. I describe my faith very similarly to how I just presented it to you, my belief in the universe, and I go out and touch trees and dig my hands in dirt and lay in rivers if I want to hear the universe better. I understand that there's some power in charge, and I will absolutely refer to it as God, but I or Allah. But I really think that like. That's a bigger concept than we can wrap our puny brains around because we're just humans and like we're really trying to simplify something that's clearly so above and beyond us. And we've been told that we can't understand it, but we feel like we do. And they pray for me and they tell me that they respect my faith and they think that it is beautiful. I don't have a single Muslim friend that thinks I'm going to hell. All of them tell me that, they hope that Allah gives me all of the happiness in the world, and they know that like they understand now. Put me in a Christian church and let me tell them what I think. Like the tolerance is and the understanding, because for them truly it's really just about being a good person. And humanity. So when I talk to anybody that I know that I talk to in Palestine on a regular basis, it is my brother and my sister. That is how we all refer to each other. And that to me is solidarity. And I think that too. Oh, that's a good segue into my mom. So my mom had sent me something about it was the beginning of December, maybe. I don't remember if I called her, she called me, or what, but it was something in regards to Palestine. And I was like, well, where the hell did this come from? Because my family was conservative. They are conservative, whatever. Build the wall kind of people still. Like, they don't understand like that. The illegal immigrants aren't doing this. They don't understand any of that. They don't. And it
They are the
was
caricature of conservatism.
they are a cliche through and through. But I will say too that if you were to take away that hatred from their heart that was indoctrinated into them, they are some of the most emotionally intelligent people I've ever met. And I think that that's something that's super prevalent in Appalachia, because we see that in the mutual aid and the direct aid in solidarity you see in communities. Everything from, fundraisers for someone who got sick to like high school sporting events. The way people go so hard to support those things. Like there's community solidarity across the board, and an understanding that you, like, when everyone's doing well, you're doing well. We just have to, like, remove the blinders and remember that we have to spread that, and our power is the ability to spread that. Because damn, if you could take what we do in those places and you could spread that kind of solidarity outward, it changes things. Because anytime I've gone into a more urban setting, I guess we can say, and done some kind of large scale direct action, direct aid thing, people are always like, well, where did you get this idea from? And I'm like, oh, this is something they do at home all the time. You think they have free spaghetti dinners? Like, just because sometimes it's the only hot meal people eat. And so it makes a big impact though, then. And then that mentality spreads. And my thing is kind of going into places, kind of like organizing, dumping that kind of stuff, and then people. The vibe is infectious. People pick it up. We organize those people together. We show them that they can do the thing. We put the avenues in place. We do the networking. And then that community is more self-sustaining.
It's a cultural shift. Yeah, it's
Yes.
organizing for the cultural change just as much, which is like just spot on for
And
the podcast. And
it's just being Appalachian, just in other settings.
exactly. Yeah. I mean, potlucks are literally mutual aid. I bring something, you bring something, we both eat two things.
Another juxtaposition between Palestine and Appalachia. We don't have an astronomical houseless rate in Appalachia. You stay with somebody. Somebody's going to make space for you. A church is going to make space for you, even out in the middle of nowhere, right? Like, you don't have vast waves of hunger, because people will organize and find a way to make it work. There is not a high houseless rate or like high going without food rate when they're not in the middle of like such an active genocide. Obviously now there is, but there wasn't before in Palestine, because you stayed with somebody. You didn't sleep outside. You didn't without food if I have food. It was. So it's truly showing you that the communities who have the least do the most for each other.
We take care of us. We keep us safe.
Yes, and that is too, like, you'll see, like, when that's why it's so devastating when they blow up these homes, because again, you're not looking at one generation or two generations, you're looking at three or four and a bunch of other distant relatives and maybe some friends too who are living there because they took care of each other. And still going back around to my mama. Yeah, poor, start crying again. Whew. So we're talking, and she's a cliche. Her my dad are cliches, and she was just kind of like asking me about it. And this is, try to recap. It was about 4 months ago, but it's pretty damn well burned in my brain. She sat on the phone with me for 3 or 4 hours. She created an Instagram account, followed all the journalists that I sent her, watches all my stories, watches TikToks. My mother is on disability for a really tragic accident she was in when I was like 10. on her spine. She has like no spine really left. The discs and everything, like she's a robot back there at this point in time. It's horrible. And she donated on my birthday to the Palestinian Children Relief Fund because that's what I had asked for. We weren't even talking. My mother and I haven't spoken or anything on my birthday in over half a decade. She donated twice, $20 and then $6. And anyone who is poor knows that that means she had $6 left later and went back and donated it. And we sat and we talked about all of it. And it was healing for me because it was actually, there was a moment where she reminded me to not get like lost in it. And I immediately got defensive because everyone constantly is always telling me, you know, like, okay, we have to step away. I'm like, that's not how I work. And it's so frustrating because people don't get that about me, that like, I can't. Like, as soon as I see it, my brain's on it and that's it. And it's the meltdown I'm having is genuine and painful. And I'm truly the whole time just trying to figure out what I can do to get this to stop for them. And the only person in this world who I felt like understood that about me was my sister. And so she was really keeping me afloat during all of this, really like making sure I didn't drown in it. And my mom had mentioned to me, like, you know, like watching out. And I kind of was just like, I can't stop this. Like, I can't stop. You know, I can't stop this. And for the first time, I honestly, well, no, the second time in my life, second time in my life, I felt like my mother saw me. She said, I know that. That's how you are. That's how you've always been. This is who you are. I can't ask you not to be that. I'm never going to ask you to look away. I know you're not going to look away. Just don't forget to take care of yourself. Don't get lost in the hole again. Did you shower? Are you eating? And I was like, oh, shit. I did take a shower, but I have not eaten. And she was like, okay, go get something to eat. But I understand you're not going to look away. You can't. And I didn't, that was a moment too, talking about healing childhood trauma. That was a moment that I realized, I think in a big way, that my mom didn't inherently think I was always a bad person. That my mom was just a really broken person, but who really truly always did believe that I genuinely do just care this much about other people. And that's why I do everything that I do every single day, that I am alive to try to help other people. And I had a very abusive childhood. So to get that was, oh my God, healing. Palestine is truly healing and freeing the entire world right now in so many ways, because this conversation wouldn't have happened if she wasn't willing to sit down and talk to me about this. And my thought process was, is I will sit down and I will break this no contact over this if she's asking me about this, because this, there's nothing more important, especially now, my own feelings. But we talked for hours about it and she was hysterical. I was sending her links and she was asking questions, because my mom was also a post 9/11 like scare person, you know, like I remember watching her watch the towers like fall down on repeat on the news. You know what I mean? Like, we're sitting there, she came home and watched it again and again while I was on the news all evening. And I'm just trying to watch SpongeBob because I'm in like elementary school and I'm like, I get that this is happening. Why do we have to keep watching it? This is insane. And I highly recommend going and looking into the Mom's Letter to America if you guys haven't yet already, to figure out why 9/11 happened. Also, Israel celebrated it, just saying. Not Palestine. Israel celebrated it on American soil. And I'll provide links for that later.
Do I will include those links in the show notes if you send them to me.
I will
I mean, this
absolutely.
is a full-blown, that's, we're going to refer to it as a conspiracy podcast, and we're going to say allegedly a lot, but we're going to provide a lot of resources and
Oh,
a lot of citations for everything
yeah.
that
Oh, yeah.
we
No, you're gonna,
say is allegedly.
you're all kinds of. But we talked for hours about Palestine and she started to really get it. She was asking me questions. I explained to her what a jihad is, that it's not a scary word. And it's, I
The
explained to
people,
her.
for the people, what is it?
Okay, so a jihad is like an interpersonal battle, I think would be my way of, but my best way of describing it, is from taking all of the great information I've been given and compounding it. So an example my friend gave me was, she had a friend who, her name is actually Jihad, because her mother went through an incredibly difficult labor. And it was a willpower thing of getting through that. You know, when you're laboring, it's a willpower thing. You're battling with your own body. And so it was a physical and mental battle that she overcame, she felt like. And so she named her daughter that. So if you're in the middle of that, like you're trying to overcome some big inner battle to come out a better person on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a jihad,
it's
something
ego
like,
death. Yeah.
Yeah. It's such a great way of like really, truly like showing self-discipline or self-control, something like that. Like really like taking yourself to a new level with an actual battle inside yourself. How the hell is that a bad thing? I call it self-improvement, but I mean, that's just me. But I explained those things to her. I explained to her the way in which my friend had been looking out for me, and that really struck home with her. The sense of solidarity then of me being like, oh yeah, no, they got the boys Christmas gifts. They made sure that this was taken care of. They gave us this. They do this. They're so nice. They check in on this. Like, they're constantly worried about this for us. Like, they're the sweetest.
Can I also just name like how radical that is to, and I think, I don't know if it's clear to you or like if it'll be clear to folks listening to this, but the fact that you don't think twice about also accepting help from the folks who you feel driven to stand in solidarity with, like that's actual solidarity as opposed to saviorism. Right. Which is such a common, like, and you've already kind of named this, that it was about your feelings, like, but it was something much deeper than that. It was about the principles that caused the feelings. And so many white folks in particular, we get uncomfortable and we don't know why we're uncomfortable. And so then we like make it about, oh my God, I have to make this discomfort go away. I need to make this about me, center myself, and recreate the power dynamic, right? Where it's like the charity dynamic, like I'm here to help you just to make this go away. It's not like, of course, I can't take anything from you. No, 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 no. Like there are people who need it so much more than me. Oh my gosh. But the true reciprocity, that is where transmutation happens.
I love that you're pointing that out, because it's really something to me that I've never really thought on much. And I think it's genuinely because from each according to their ability, to each according to their need, and that's really how I see it. And I'm so grateful at the end of the day that I don't see it as a transaction either. Like I go out there and I do the thing, so they do this thing for me. It's I was there and they felt how I felt. And we connected, and they're good, like just the best people I've ever met in my life. And they wanted to turn around and take care of me the way in which they would take care of a friend, someone that they felt this way for. And that's what I was doing for them. That situation where I went after the guy and had like the knife situation. Yeah, don't threaten my friends. Well, I will put my white ass right there. And but that's it. Like that's what it is. Like it's not like, oh, that's a person that needs my help. It's like, oh,
that's a part of me. That's my part of me. Yeah.
My person needs my help. Like, and it's the same as I would view helping family, really truly. To me, family, the blood of the coven is so much thicker than the water of the womb. And my family is whoever it is that I say that it is. And that is, you know, what I believe in the universe, giving us the ability to connect to each other in the way in which we can sometimes. I think that it reiterates that. And so, like, one day, I swear to God, one day, I'm going to be dancing around in the West Bank because I promised my friends there that I would. And I believe that the universe is going to bring me and my brothers and sisters together. And but that's I've been invited there so many times. When this is over, when this is over, you will be given the best hospitality you've ever seen. I've been told so many times, and I believe it every single time. And hospitality is a huge hospitality is a huge Middle Eastern tradition. It is such a staple hospitality, even in communities where they have very little, some familiar hospitality is life. So in these scenarios too, I know when I step outside of Appalachia and I get to more places where that sense of solidarity and giving isn't necessarily always there, that me giving the way I want to give sometimes can seem like overwhelming. Do you know what I mean? Can be overly hospitable. And that is another reason why I feel so at home and at ease, I think, with my Arabic friends, because that sense of hospitality is just as strong, if not stronger. So when I do it, they're like, oh my gosh, thank you, amazing, here, ha. And I'm like, oh, thank you, amazing, here, ha. Like, and it's just, you're just throwing love balls back and forth, whatever that looks like. And I think we can see evidence of them being like this innately like that in the footage that we're watching right now. Because even in the worst of the moments, or Mohammed, the
Or
man that
even
I met.
in the fact that this revolution was able to take place. Like, you cannot, I think about the labor uprisings in Appalachian history, and those were not possible without the what I call comfort captains of the union efforts. Like, people, like striking unionizers were literally getting kicked out of their company housing. They didn't have anywhere to go. They needed a roof over their head. They didn't have food, et cetera. So hospitality was a part of the organizing. It had to fucking exist. Same thing with the Palestinian Revolution.
But I got Muhammad enough money to feed his family for a little while, right? And he said, basically, let's figure out how to start a soup kitchen because I can't take care of me. And he was like, I
And
hope
that might be the
today.
last $450 that he gets. So might as
But
well
if
make it
everybody
as go
likes
as far as it
meat.
can.
And he said, I hope that you're happy with it, but I've been sharing like all of my thing. Like, and I was like, buddy, from God's hands to yours, because I was just in the middle here. I was just a vessel. Money isn't real. It'll come back around. But like, no, like I know you're gonna share. You're Palestinian. Don't imply I send you enough to cover everybody's stuff for a day. Cause yeah. But again, he got that little bit of hope and he's immediately hit the ground with we're organizing something to launch a fundraiser to keep money going over there. He's come up with a dollar amount. He's working with his buddy who goes and gets water and fills the jugs and brings them back for all the kids. I get videos every day of the kids going and collecting the water jugs. We have figured out how much it costs in gas to be able to go find a place where they can fill up water jugs and everything like that every day for everyone. Like we're sitting and banging all the numbers out. Because now that we're seeing World Central Kitchen turning their aid around and everything like that, we've got to work with the ridiculous prices that they have inside there for the little bit of stuff that they're able to get into there to sell via capitalism. So we get to deal with the markups. So it's really truly starved to death unless you have money that no one has a way of having because they're in a camp and everything is blown up.
And I want to pause
So.
us because we're talking about this as folks who have been, you in particular, even more deeply than me, like in it and paying attention and keeping up with things and like knowing what's going on. But I actually kind of want to assume that folks might listen to this episode who even still, 180 days after this has all started, like might not understand. Like it is a big, heavy topic, and our instinct under the circumstances of a quickly collapsing empire and a dying world are to run from it because we're like, we've had enough. Like, I don't understand this. I can't handle any more. So no shame and no shade for anyone who might be listening, especially if folks are like burnt out on news, like mainstream media, and don't know where else to turn for their news. And like maybe the people that they follow haven't said anything about it, or made it very clear why this, exactly, or made it very clear why this matters. So like, let's imagine someone listening to this conversation who has no fucking clue, just thinks like, okay, Middle East, wars happening again and doesn't know anything other than the fact that there's Jewish and Islam groups involved. Let's just start, like, where do we start, Tierra? Where do we start? Take me, Miss Frizzle, take me on a journey.
Listen, we're gonna write this one down. So, my mom, real quick.
Your mom. All right, I'm gonna do this too.
So I found out that my mom actually spent Christmas Eve or Christmas Day, I can't remember now, Christmas Day, in the trailer park in Juniata County. All right, trailer park, Juniata County. And I want you to understand that when you say Pennsylvania, you say Juniata County. Okay. It's been on national news a couple times making fun of them for how blindly they supported Donald Trump. While also simultaneously openly saying that he was negatively affecting the local economy. I'm like, it's bad. It's cliche. It's cliche. It really is. And my mom spent Christmas in the trailer park. My mom is hospitable, and she will cook for widowers or anyone who doesn't have anywhere to go on holiday. And you could always come to my mama's house. And people always did. We always had a bunch of random people come to our house. And so my sister said that, and when my mom then mentioned it to me, that my mom's been watching stuff all day, every day. By the end of the conversation I had with her, she also does no longer condemn Hamas. She listened and said that she would support her grandson.
So weird. That's wild.
She supported her grandsons in that scenario. And that's how you have to present it sometimes. If my boys had to pick pieces of me up and put them in a bag and carry them to a hospital, mom. In 20 years, if they rose up against the tyrannical government who still controlled every moment of their lives and had killed off half of their brothers, would you condemn them? No, fuck no, of course not. You would hide your grandbabies. You would help them. But that's all had to be presented to her as too. And I saw her get it in ways I've never seen her get this stuff before, because I've always presented her these things in this way. And what got to me is she said, I'm going to listen to whatever you say because I know that you've never just said this stuff and lied about it. But she spent Christmas feeding people and talking about Palestine. So without me prompting it, I wasn't even there. She brought it up. Trailer park.
Mm-hmm.
Cliche redneck town. The lady who feeds all of the people who have nowhere to go. She's talking about how she's pro-Palestine.
Mm.
And that was the moment that I realized that we're going to win.
Mm-hmm. Ugh, and what a powerful testimony to the fact, like, for one, the universe is a hologram and everything's fractal, and like the small is the large, right? Like your independent healing and your ability to stand firm in your truth on Palestine. Like, I can just, from how you're describing it, like in my mind's eye, I can just see like how that must have helped your mom do some kind of healing in her own right to even be able to say to you and validate you the ways that she did and say the things that she did. And then in turn for her to then share that. And like, it just speaks to the fact that we don't all need to be going out trying to be the loudest voice or doing the most. We need to be focusing on being true to ourselves and like standing firm in our truth and healing our shit. So that way it can ripple out.
Absolutely. And I was so proud of her. Again, like, I'm saying apprehensive and whatnot, but as a person who can compartmentalize and whatnot, I can look at it as a person who made a lot of mistakes, lost their daughter, saw this, and in a really hard moment chose to grow. But yeah, I think we're gonna see the shift too, because we can personify things so much too. Like my niece was a NICU baby, so I made my mom look what they did to those NICU babies.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what if that was Abby? Screen crimes over the thought, you know? And she could see it for the first time. So, but that's what changed her too. You can see it. You can see it. And I said, well, just go look. And she said, you trust that these are good sources? Because again, they have them so brainwashed that if it's coming out of the Middle East, it must be a lie, right? Unless it's coming from Israel. And I was like, no, I'm like, they're for real. They're for real. I've actually even spoken to some of them. But I don't know why I have to tell you this, but yes, mom, they're very, very real. And that was it. That's what she needed. And I think that it's going to take parents like that too. Older generation people listening and trusting their children, respecting their children enough to believe them when they say, no, th this is real. I really looked into this. Please just listen to me on this one. As well, I'm not finding a lot of people like our age and younger who that you won't find many who pro-Israel.
I think it's really like a turn. It's similar to the way that Vietnam was televised, like the first televised war. Like we're really, this is such just an interesting point in the space-time continuum that we're sitting in right now, where like there's that generational divide of technological literacy and just and exactly what you said, like knowing what sources are reliable, even and then further AI, right? Just literally so convenient how AI exploded in the last year and is one of the prime tools being weaponized by the IDF for their fucking massacre, and simultaneously is also being used to spread mass misinformation, which is something that actually in a training I was in this 2022, it might have been, maybe it was last year, but it might have been early last year in 2023, about AI and organizing. We were talking about how AI would be able to be used for things like making a fake image of two people standing next to each other who would never be caught dead next to each other, blah, blah, blah. Right. And so, like, it's like part of
Weapons of
the
mass media.
exact, propaganda. Like, it's another tool for propaganda. It's another tool for narrative. And it dim it, there's another intersection point of technological literacy because, like, for one, understanding what all AI is capable of is what is necessary to even begin to train your brain to identify AI in action. And so, like, there's definitely a generational advantage for younger generations, and even just being able to conceptualize the capacity that AI can be used for in misinformation, and to even think when we see a picture that looks kind of off. Like, it's like the whole generation before us, you know, is like, oh my God, this picture, like they don't even think it's a fake picture, right? But we see the picture, and like the generational differences are like, now I
Like
automatically
Donald
think,
Trump is not
like,
sure riding an eagle in front of the sun and holding an American flag, Robert.
I've literally seen people our age, like early 30s, late 20s, share. There was this page called OBX something. It's about the Outer Banks in North Carolina. And folks were sharing this, like, it was a clearly AI image of like flooded streets from like one of the storms at like the end of last year that supposedly had hit the coast, and like it had not hit the coast yet. And I just called this person out. This person went to grad school with me, has an MSW, and was sharing this. And I was like, my friend, like, this is actually an issue that you are sh that you one like couldn't identify this because you need to train yourself. Like, that's, you need to be competent at that. Like, and then two, that you like shared this and legitimately thought it was real. Like, so the AI, anyways, my point being, like, we're, and then Palestine. So Palestine, one, being accessible to those of us who know how to use, like, the real issues, what's happening in Palestine on the ground, being accessible to those of us who know how to use technology and have that level of literacy, but then also like the resilience against the inoculation that they are trying to propagandize us with. And then like the intersection of, I think further that like we have, our generation is like, we have nothing left to lose. And exactly, like, we are at the point where we are already taking care of each other because we can't fucking rely on them. So this point in time space. I know this was a rant and soapbox, but my point is that like it's such a culminating point. I mean, since 2020, we have been building this. I mean, 2020 is when like mass strikes like started to really pop off for the first time because workers were like, what you want me to do what for what exactly? And from then it's just gotten worse and worse and worse. And we're at this point now where exactly the shift is happening. And it's a multi-generational shift because it's happening from the inside out. And it's like an emotional shift. It's a political shift. It's a cultural shift. It's all of these things simultaneously. And I think Palestine is this really just, it's this trigger moment.
It feels conspiracy theory-ish, crazy to say, but I think we're living through something that hasn't been really seen before. I really do. I think we're really, again, we'll do a whole episode on biblical prophecy. And then I have a whole rant about the importance of independent journalism and the reality of like the need for that is, you know, anti-capitalized journalism means that we're going to not be able to have mass media reporting networks, that people are going to have to really work together. But we're seeing now that that can work.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that these journalists have such a large following online and we have these platforms where they can have a large following independently online now. I'm a huge fan of social media. I'm a friggin' slut for social media. Let me tell you what. Like, I think that it is going to save the entire world. And everyone's like, no, it's not ruining jack shit. If divorce rates are up, it's because we can all talk about how shitty our husbands were to each other and we weren't isolated anymore. Like, it's not a bad thing that we're like the things that we're getting from it. It's just letting people be people.
It's another neutral tool that can be used for either positive or negative.
It's letting be people.
Exactly.
Yep. And it's just, you're being a person on a bigger scale. And for some of us, that means humanitarian aid, or it means the class solidarity, or it means empathizing with a stranger. Because like these aren't just like these are people with names and homes and backstories that we all know now, and we don't have to go through some pre-selected Israeli owned news outlet to information anymore. We can go straight to a Palestinian in Palestine and who has proven that they are a good person, a brave person, a strong person, a courageous person, and a genuinely wholesome human being, reputable. And we can go follow them and we can see with our own fucking eyes via live stream, which can't be fake. Like, what's happening right there? And so they'll stand there and they'll tell us no. But then we can also have, you know, like Greg Stokes, who's like, no, this is a hellfire missile. This is what a hellfire missile does. There's no way they accidentally hit this shit. And then he can prove that to us. And you know what his credentials are? He's a fucking professional. Like, you won't find someone with better credentials who's going to debate him. But then we can just support those people. If half of the people who followed these journalists sent them like $5 a month, they'd be set, you know? Like,
exactly. It's really like Patreon. That's one thing about like Patreon and like subscriber culture that capitalism might have made an oopsie on, where it's like, it really is like allowing us to redistribute wealth according to what we find valuable, as opposed to like,
they underestimated humanity when they gave us social media and things like that. They thought that we were going to use it for stupid shit, and they didn't realize that we were still human beings at the core, and that we would use it to support and love each other, and that we would see through their bullshit and we would connect with each other more. They didn't expect that because they don't have the ability anymore, the ruling class, to see us as capable of those kinds of feelings, because we were just animals to them. And we would even expect more from animals. But that's how poorly they think of us and how confident they are in their ability to have turned us all against each other and made us such independent mindset kind of people. And they're seeing now that when they took everything from us, the only thing they left us was our humanity.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Yeah.
Only we have left to
I don't. There's no one left for me to step on, so guess I'm shooting up.
Like, it's just so we can see in real time that if they come for you in the night, they'll come for me in the morning.
Exactly.
And the
And
only
that
thing.
they have been coming after each of us systematically over the course of centuries.
But again, that's the importance of the whole solidarity factor. And again, I haven't found a group of people to genuinely like. And I'm obviously like really big into talking about differences. I have always been that person who does the taboo thing. Like, oh, we're not supposed to talk about like what color we are. Let's talk about it. There's no chance in hell that an Arabic person was walking up to my mother on the street and having her bring Palestine into the trailer park. But I'm willing to talk about the differences to my mother. I'm willing to call the shit out as it is. I'm willing to tell her that it's racism. I'm willing to paint the picture for her and then just make them brown and say that's your issue. I will say the things directly and I will draw the direct comparisons culturally too. I think that we do need to do that. I think that it's such a Western idea because we don't really have a lot of fucking culture as white people, as a bunch of colonizers, we don't have culture. So we avoid talking about the culture of others. But culturally, Arabic people are much more welcoming, opening, and show a lot more solidarity than your average Western Joe Schmo white man. And I will, yeah, no. And then that's why my favorite thing in the entire world to hear, I think, is when I get to one of these events and I hear, it's our favorite white girl. And but like, it's because, yeah, I get it. I get it. Because I can't imagine how terrifying it has to be for them if I know if I open my mouth, I'm going to get screamed at. And I also know that they're not afraid of them because I've seen way too many white people walk through an Arabic rally screaming terrorists at the top of their lungs and people you're afraid of yelling things like that. That's why I'll chase them down because I unfortunately live in a system where there's power in whiteness. So here I fucking am. And if I'm somewhere where some kind of act of aggression is being demonstrated towards someone who is a brother or sister of mine, and it's a situation in which my privilege can act as a shield, then it is my duty as their brother or sister to go over there and do that. And in the same capacity, maybe their shield doesn't look like a physical shield like mine does, but in a sense, I think a good way of looking at it is I had a financial shield then put over me, and I was able to pay my mortgage and not lose my house in December. Thanks to my friend who literally just saw that I was stressing and got a hold of her husband and was like, hey, can you figure something out? And he did. And that to me is solidarity, is to looking around, seeing our differences. Because if I'm not willing to acknowledge that I'm white and I have privilege in that situation, or that they're Arabic and they're at risk in that situation, then I will not go ahead and I will not weaponize my privilege in that situation, which is exactly what I did. Because when that man turned around then after I chased him down, he thought he was turning around to someone who did not look like him. So he turned around looking one way and he spun all the way back around and walked away when he realized that he didn't see who he thought he was going to see. His hand went down and everything because he was going to hit me. And then he saw it as a white lady.
Well,
And
it's like when I
then
was.
you know they're mad about that then too, because then you get very specific things yelled back at you then. It's no longer getting yelled at that I was a terrorist. No. I was a stupid cunt. Like,
Well,
oh.
it also makes me think of like when I was knocking, doing all the door knocking, and it was very different. Like, I actually did have black canvassers who worked for me during some of our canvases, and I would have a discussion with them about like what neighborhood, I mean, they were from here, we were all locals, and like I would be like, what neighborhoods do or don't you want to knock on doors in? Because we all know, we all know that there are some neighborhoods that you just don't want to walk down. Okay? But I knew I have one, the privilege of being a little white girl who's from here. Two, I have like the weird privilege of living under patriarchy where it's like really disarming to be like a 5'2", like petite white woman, like, and just throw on that accent real thick as I'm walking up to them. And it's like a whole different experience because I'm understanding of like what my role and my position is in that situation in the larger context, right?
Who will listen to you? Because you're going to get someone to listen to you that other people cannot. And you
What
go
do I
make them.
have to work with?
post spicy stuff, and in the middle, I post profile sex stuff. Okay? Because then we're going to start conversations. They're going to be like, damn, girl. Also, what? And then, oh,
Exactly.
you're listening to me. You're more likely to listen to me because of this reason. So thank you so much for joining. Thanks really much for tuning in. Let's discuss it. And it's just one of the, 500 different random ways that I try to use whatever space that I'm in to just have it be a topic of conversation. Because I think of it like this. If it was my sister, if it was my children, if it was, oh my God, if it was my friends, I would talk about it every space I was in. And it is my sister, and it is my children, and it is my friends, because they are human beings. So I'm talking about it in every space that I'm in. And that changes things too then. Like, it normalizes it as well, because it does catch people off guard the moments in which I'll talk to people about it and I'll bring it up. But then it means that the next time that they're in a situation where they think maybe it's not appropriate to bring it up, they're gonna be like, no, you can bring this shit up anywhere. And you should be bringing this up everywhere. Because they're torturing children to death. And we
Yeah,
have
I
so
just
much now, like, we have so much evidence of that. It's right there. There's no denying it, and any denial that they give us is a blatant fuck you to our emotional intelligence, our psychological intelligence. Like, it's pure gaslighting and poorly at this point in time. And they really just think that we're stupid enough to just keep going. And I just implore people to not let them make you feel that way.
And if the tens of thousands of people who have been brutally slaughtered during this genocide, if that isn't enough to compel you to take a stance or to investigate or to speak up because maybe you feel like, and actually, this is pretty common in movement spaces where we silo issues into like it has to be environment or jobs. It has to be local politics. There's no time for global politics. It has to be reproductive rights or gun rights, right? Like we silo all of these things, and some folks will feel like that is what is preventing them from looking into or claiming a position on occupied Palestine because it's off mission, because it's off, whatever their issue is. But I am here to dispel the myth that any of the issues that any of us face are disconnected. Whenever we talk about Palestine, we are talking about Appalachia. We are talking about the Pratt and Whitney, the Raytheon war plants. We are talking about the economic disenfranchisement that forces our people to go manufacture the bombs that are being dropped on the brown kids over in the Middle East. When we talk about Palestine, we are talking about the fucking media that has warped their narrative in the same way that it has warped Appalachian narratives, in the same way that it has warped Indigenous narratives, in the same way that it has warped Black narratives. When we talk about Palestine, we are talking about Appalachia and the fact that our own government bombed us because we didn't give in to capitalist white supremacist agenda. And that is exactly what the fuck is happening in Palestine. And if we don't talk about Palestine because we are too busy focusing on climate change, because we are too busy focusing on American politics and the fact that it's a presidential election year, if we don't talk about Palestine, we are ignoring all of the issues that we say that we care about. Ugh, I hate to do it to us, but with that mic drop of a note, we are going to have to wrap up the episode for today. But don't worry, like I said, the conversation does go on. So we will be back with the rest for you next week. Lord willing and the creek don't rise, if I can get all the editing done. And in the meantime, make sure to follow us on social media, subscribe to the show, share us with all your friends. And if you want to support us financially, you can head over to ko-fi.com/rednecksrising. Take good care of yourselves. Until next time.